You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the open banking movement. Whether you're a financial expert, banking executive, or everyday consumer, open banking affects everyone and will change the way we interact with our money. I'm Eyal Saman, your host. This episode is brought to you by Ozone API, unlocking the power of open finance all over the world. Open banking is, in fact, just the beginning. In the open banking community, it has become commonplace to expound that open banking will lead to open finance, and that open finance will lead to open data. The general idea is that the common standards used to share banking data will inevitably expand in scope. First, leading to open finance standards, which cover more and more financial products like stocks or insurance, and then to open data standards, which will eventually cover all sectors of the economy: telecom, energy, healthcare, and beyond. In fact, this transition is already taking place. In Brazil, open insurance has been live for years. In the UK, an open energy project is already underway. Many budding open banking regimes move beyond just banking on day one. But talk of the march towards open data would be incomplete, even unthinkable, without addressing the pivotal role of Australia. Australia is something of an open banking hero. Although their regulatory efforts came after their peers in the UK and Europe, they did not call their new regulation Payments Directive or even open banking. They called it Consumer Data Rights, marking the first time open banking legislation was used to shine a light down the road we had all begun to walk. As far as the Australians were concerned, if you have a right to share your banking data, you should have a right to share all your data, making them the true pioneers of open data. Australia has now been on the road to data rights for several years. Unfortunately, despite starting with such bold ambitions, reality has fallen far short of the vision. Sometimes, all that glitters is not gold. Our guest is here to tell us the story of what went wrong and what can be done to get Australia back on track. Jamie Leach was recently hired as Radium's open data strategist to strengthen the company's authority in Australasia and Asia Pacific. A self-proclaimed data champion, she is also the regional director of FData Australasia and the founder of Open Data Australia. Jamie also serves as a strategic advisor to Smarter Contracts and is the board chair at GridCube. As a staunch advocate for effective data policy, she provides advice and support concerning data strategy, privacy, and governance to clients from both public and private spheres. With a strong background in finance and economics, Jamie is dedicated to empowering data owners and users alike by contributing to technological advancements in digital identity and open finance. Jamie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Eyal. It is my distinct pleasure to join you today.
For some context, could you give us all a brief lay of the land in terms of open banking in Australia? What makes it unique?
Open banking in Australia is not just open banking. So if we go right back to the start, when Australia decided that they were going to consider open banking, The then Treasurer, who became Prime Minister soon after that, Scott Morrison, commissioned a review into the potential for open banking in Australia. The chair of that review is a gentleman named Scott Farrell. Scott reviewed a number of jurisdictions, namely the UK, and considered the concept of would open banking be good for Australia. What came out of that was Scott's recommendation that not only would open banking be considered a good thing for Australia and its citizens, but that Australia had the potential to really leverage its data. What started out as a concept for open banking in Australia quickly became the consumer data right, which was envisioned to go far past this concept of just sharing banking data, including many subsequent sectors, to what would eventually become an open data economy in Australia. The end goal is to be far broader and deeper than just banking data.
Hence the name Consumer Data Right, abbreviated as CDR. Tell us a little more about CDR. What makes it so significant?
This concept that a consumer should be able to direct the data that they share with parties that can supply a product or a service where consent is pivotal to that transaction of data. I once asked Scott, why did we want to introduce a consumer data right as opposed to open banking? Off the back of a productivity commission, off the back of a number of royal banking commissions, the Haynes Review, there are a number of things in Australia that literally said Australia was not leveraging its data, not just in creating a fair level playing field in financial services, but much broader than that. So Scott, being a partner of a very large law firm, quickly recognised that data really translates to a concept of digital right. And Scott argued that if we brought in consent in the middle of a consumer data right, it would afford, through legislative reform, the ability for a consumer to, in theory, direct what data was shared with whom for what was considered an acceptable purpose. Now, that was the original intent. Banking just happened to be the first cab off the rank due to a number of financial services issues and a perception of a lack of innovation and competition. But the underlying premise of consumers choosing their data to share with whom for a product or service was at the center of the consumer data right.
And to be clear, across the economy, so when you say broader than financial services, you mean that the CDR applied to data from every sector. Is that right?
At the end of the day, it should. It was envisaged to. As each sector is proposed by our Treasury Department, it is then mandated by the Minister and it is added to the portfolio. So what started with banking was then followed by energy data. Originally, the timeline then went telecommunications data, retirement pension data, then other forms of financial services data, such as non-bank lending, general insurance, and the list was always perceived to be long. But depending on where the priorities were as a nation or where the reform was happening in different sectors, there was always going to be a lineup of future sectors to be added to the consumer data right. That was the intention. And that was the way it was always designed to expand.
So, whereas others may have thought of open banking as a stepping stone to open finance and eventually open data, Australia started with open data right at the beginning.
That's correct. And I think there were a number of different events and reasons that led us to start with that. I once said to Scott Farrell, why on earth did you choose to go so deep, so overarching from the start? And he shared with me that he knew he would only get one bite of the cherry. When it comes to legislative reform, when it comes to bringing really grand whole-of-nation changes around tech and data and digital, you don't get the opportunity to keep stepping up to the plate and introducing new things. He swung for the rafters, and I think he actually hit it out of the ballpark. But there's a big difference between the starting point and where we have gotten to now. You also need to think that there were a couple of other factors that really drove, I think, his methods, his decisioning. The Productivity Commissioner back in 2015, really highlighting that unless data started to move around our economy, we would not realise the true potential for digital reform, the digital economy. We had the Attorney General saying the same thing. We had a number of public reports being made by McKinsey where they started to actually quantify predicted figures, something like $232 billion uptick over a 9-year period. Deloitte's put out a report that I think said a $49 billion increase in the economy based on digital and data sharing and almost 50,000 jobs year on year. Australia, I think, recognises in theory the potential for real digital economy uptick if we can get this data sharing working. But there's a big difference between planning and reality.
Before we move ahead into reality, this must have been quite an exciting time, the early days of CDR. In open banking regions around the world, Australia was often held up as a beacon of the future to come, of this philosophically ambitious approach. What was the reaction at that time from Scott Farrell, yourself, and the team working on it?
At that time, I don't think I had been more excited about the potential for some sort of digital or data reform in quite some time. In Australia, whilst we had an open data policy, it was quite sometimes slow and painful to get government to move in any direction or to adopt anything too widespread. So I'd been fighting that fight for a number of years. And then this came along. And suddenly, this wasn't just about government sharing data. This was about industry data. This was about consumers being able to receive real-time product and service in an enhanced, secure model. This had the promise of revolutionizing technology and consumer adoption that benefit to not just industry, but citizens. It was really promising to literally be the biggest thing that was going to happen probably in my lifetime.
Now, for the first several years, things seemed to be going pretty smoothly for a while. Is that right?
Correct. As smooth as they can. So we didn't just choose in Australia the top banks. We mandated every bank with a banking license. They were automatically in. Our big four banks were mandated to go live first, and then every other bank had a starting timeline of roughly 12 months later. We also then carved out two or three different data stages and product reference data went live first. So that was seen as being almost the low-hanging fruit for testing out the technology and the accreditations. Then came the actual consumer data, the transaction data. And then that was broken into transaction accounts versus credit cards versus mortgages. In the beginning, so we're going back to 2020, 2021, we eventually got all of the banks across the line, or the vast majority, and everybody rejoiced because now data is flowing. And pretty soon after that, Open Energy was mandated and Open Energy went live. And at that point, we were very excited about what would come next. So in the beginning, all actually looked incredibly promising.
In the early days, the sky was the limit. Starting in 2018, with an ambitious plan in place, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, or ACCC, proceeded to introduce consent-based data sharing to the entire economy, one sector at a time. First, banking went live in 2020, and then energy in 2022. Everything was going relatively smoothly. At this point in the story, the rest of the open banking world was watching Australia with starry-eyed envy. For a brief moment, it seemed like the dream of broad data rights may actually come to pass. But unfortunately, that's not how this story goes.
Think of it like a duck paddling on a lake. From the outside, the duck seems to be gliding effortlessly around the lake. But if you look underwater, they are usually pedaling really hard. There was a lot of that going on even in launching banking. Banking as a data set is actually quite complex. If you add to that years of transactional data with many, many, many different data points, it gets very deep, very broad. Bandwidth can be an issue. It can be challenging. Now into energy data, which isn't actually attributable to an individual at all. It's attributable to a building, a dwelling, a meter that sits on the outside. So the energy sector required a lot fewer rules, fewer protections. Energy was relatively simple compared to banking. Before energy even went live, after it was mandated, there was a change of government. And with that change of government came questions that were being asked, new pressures by subsequent sectors. Each sector obviously lobbies for why they should or shouldn't be included. And pretty quickly, telecommunications dropped off that list. It was deemed there was not sufficient benefit that could be yielded by mandating telecommunications providers to export their data, which was crushing for anybody that was expecting a whole of open data economy. Pretty shortly after that, we saw retirement pension accounts being put on hold. But then the part that was the most crushing and is still the most crushing to this day is the second phase of open banking. The ability to enact an action off the back of that data sharing was put on hold. All of the development work that had been done by government and industry for almost 2 years was put aside, and industry received word that the government would restart consultations. To be honest, that is when the feeling that this was potentially never going to see that whole of the economy rollout was really reinforced.
Often an onion analogy is used to indicate layers. In this case, we can also use it as something that might make you cry. Let's start with governance. Do you think that an aspect of what caused these challenges was an overly centralized structure? To what extent was the relationship between the regulator and the market a challenge here?
I personally think it was a massive, massive challenge. We often see the banking sector underpins a large proportion of the economy. In Australia, just as you'll see in the US and we saw in the UK, the banking lobbyists have quite a lot of power. If we look at the way that the Consumer Data Act, particularly open banking, the end method or the end package solution that was gone live, even the way the data sets were put together, what was in, what was out of scope was flawed. Even the initial data sets that were chosen and the end makeup, the governance, was designed by the big four banks, their primary lobbying group, and the data standards body. They let for months and months and months argued about what data could be exported, what data they held, even what they called different fields. And that became the end product. There were no fintechs involved in those conversations. There were no consumer advocacy groups involved in those conversations. There were no technology people largely involved in those conversations. So when you start to design systems behind closed doors, you really start to limit those governance issues. You start to color and flavor what that data economy looks like. And I do think Australia was very much impacted by decisions such as that.
Which brings us to the second layer of the onion, complexity. To what extent was the very idea of having a common data structure that could capture multiple sectors a challenge?
Each sector had the data that was involved redesigned for it, as it should. But if we talk about that overprescription or the complexity, it even goes back as far as the initial legislative reform in the Competition Act. Australia chose to go down a very legislation-heavy introduction of the consumer data right. We don't have a GDPR. We don't have an LDPR. Our Privacy Act has not really been updated for quite some time. Digital transmissions, the way that tech's changing, hadn't really been captured. So it almost felt like the legislators, when they drafted that overarching consumer data right amendment to the Competition Act, had to go very, very deep. The legislation was so prescriptive, it then forced the regulators, when they were designing the rules, to be forced into certain boxes. Who was in? Was business accounts in, or was it just consumers? What could you do with the data? Who could you share the data with? For what purpose? It almost felt like the bands got tighter and tighter and tighter until we are now in a situation in Australia, which I don't want to jump ahead in the book, but that complexity is forcing many unintended consequences in the ability to operate the consumer data right.
And that complexity only compounds when we reach that third layer of the onion, the action initiation, being able to act upon all of this data from across sectors. Can you explain the meaning behind initiate action?
Let's go back one step. When you introduce open banking, open data, the consumer data right, you can separate the process into two. You can separate any of these open data sharing ecosystems into the ability to read the data, share the data, or to do something off the back of that, or write, as we call it. Australia decided right from the start that they would separate out these two levels. And Australia went live with the read, the data sharing side, but we didn't go live with the ability to create an action off the back of that. In the UK, the most common action that people probably wouldn't even think about is the ability to make a payment or ask somebody to make a payment on your behalf. That is an action. And Australia said there's two types of actions that we will see. One is the ability to make a payment. The other is a general action initiation. And when we think of that, you think of it as, I will share my data to compare mortgage providers, for instance. And if I like that offer the bank is making me, I will just ask them to port my mortgage on my behalf. I would like to see what the best rate you can give me on a car loan. And if I am happy with that rate, I will ask you to create a car loan for me, and I might direct you to move the repayments from a certain account. Action initiation was always designed to go live maybe a year or two after the banking data started flowing, but it still hasn't happened to this day.
Fast forward to today, the ambition that was first put forth has simply not been realized. Can you give us some specifics on where adoption of the CDR is today?
Sadly, the CDR has stalled. It stalled because the ability for entities to become accredited to receive data has almost run its course. So there are businesses out there that provide very real day-to-day services for consumers, for small business. Maybe these are mortgage brokers. Maybe these are those third parties that provide an integral link in a chain of financial services. So those companies, those fintechs that maybe do the categorization of data. Based on their complexity, based on who they receive data from and who they share it to, even with consumer consent, some of these entities still cannot get accredited to participate, which means they are still being forced to screen scrape. And the consumer data right, just by design, has a heightened security posture. It is safer for the consumer and it's safer for all of the participants. If you have entities that cannot even get accredited because their business models are deemed to be not fit for purpose, that wasn't Scott's original vision or intent. We're talking about a lack of consideration for existing financial services practices by the people that built some of the regulations and legislations. There are large portions of Australians that are still finding it way too complex and cumbersome to even use open banking. There's still the majority of Australians that probably have never heard of open banking or the consumer data right. But then if you couple it with a statutory review that was completed that has caused the regulators and the legislators to take pause, and now this perception of we need to wait for the next statutory review to be done to tell us all the things that still aren't done before that wheel starts moving forward, the damage and the delay that this does to the full potential. Australia is really stagnating at the moment, and it has many different people frustrated.
Today, the consumer data right in Australia has stalled. Telecom, pensions, and action initiation are now out of scope, with little clarity on how or when they will be brought back in. There are many reasons why this is happening. Many layers to the onion. First, an overly centralized structure, often biased towards vested interests. Second, needlessly complex regulations, which led to needlessly complex standards. And third, the challenge and intricacy of creating generalized action initiation. These stumbles have caused many Australian stakeholders to take pause and reassess whether this whole idea of consumer data rights was in fact worth their effort. Glimmers of hope had started to emerge on other fronts, often in unexpected ways. Let's switch gears a bit and talk about a more positive outcome, and that's Connect ID, Australia's budding digital ID program. What is Connect ID, and why has it, in contrast to CDR, actually worked pretty well?
Connect ID is one provider that is emerging within Australia's trusted digital identity framework. Australia is going to move forward with introducing digital identity. And once again, they're introducing a framework, which is very, very important. If you're going to bring in standards, if you're going to bring in that level playing field, everyone needs to understand the rules. Connect ID is an industry-led solution that happened to go early. They went early, they went live before the legislation was finalized. There's always a risk in that, but they've played a very, very smart game. Now, how Connect ID currently works is what I like to refer to as verified identity, as opposed to the sharing of verifiable credentials. Connect ID took a lot of the learnings on consented action, if you like, from the UK, from Brazil, and now the UAE, where they're building out open banking. Essentially, it allows a consumer to go to a merchant, for instance, maybe it's an online shopping site, and say, I want to buy a product. And maybe that product requires the consumer to be 18 years of age. Now, traditionally, if I go into a shop, they will ask to see my ID, driver's license. But when you purchase things online, there's only two options. One, to tick a little box that says, I promise I am 18, which does not cut it under legislative reform if you're found to be selling a product to a minor. Or two, to use something like a green ID or provide unsafe copies of my really, really sensitive data. Connect ID saw an opportunity to say, what if there is another entity out there that has already satisfactorily identified Jamie Leach and they could vouch for Jamie Leach being 18? Who would that be? 9 times out of 10, it's going to be a bank. The other time out of 10, it's going to be somebody that's probably in government. They set about creating an ecosystem of what they saw as trusted parties that could vouch for these individuals. I go onto this merchant site online. I want to buy a product that requires me to be 18. A drop-down box comes and says, can you nominate which of these companies has already satisfactorily verified your identity? I select my primary bank, for instance. It then switches through to my primary bank's mobile banking. I log on using my everyday process that I would normally use, whether it's biometrics, whether it's facial recognition or a password, whatever your bank's normal setup is. The moment that process has been satisfactorily completed, the bank then sends a thumbs up back to the merchant saying, yep, you can trust that Jamie is Jamie and we will confirm that Jamie is over 18. The bank does not share any personal data back to that merchant other than that thumbs up token. So Connect ID saw an opportunity to get the industry to solve for this problem, even ahead of the government creating the legislation. It is going to really revolutionize data protection in this country.
A prescriptive regulator-first approach led to, ultimately, a stalled initiative. Whereas, by contrast, a market-led approach to digital ID has shown strong progress. Do you think there's something to that?
I think there is. When you see the market being bought into something by a legislator, it's always going to be a bumpy road. Can a legislative-led solution, a regulatory-led solution work? I think absolutely, if there is enough consultation done with the market, but also with the end user. And we didn't have that in this country. A number of people that were making the rules, the legislation, were doing things about subjects and topics that they have very little, if any, real-world experience with. And that's why I think sometimes if the market leads the development, I still believe there is a need often for regulation or legislative reform to enforce it. But there's nothing wrong with the market saying this is how it could or will work and then we'll work with government to make sure it does work that way. There is a need for both forces to work together.
Is there an opportunity for Connect ID to complement CDR, help it get unstalled, and for the two to merge?
I believe yes. And I do believe we will absolutely see that intersection of data, payments, and identity. We need to, because this is how consumers go about their daily lives now. This is how businesses go about their daily lives. We want to be able to share our data for convenience. We want that real-time provision of a product or service. Most of the time, off the back of that, there will be a requirement for money to move. Fundamentally, before money moves, I would feel better as a consumer if I can say, can you just verify it is me before you start taking money out of my bank account? Or can you verify it's me before you start sharing my data? If we can see the amalgamation of data, payments, and identity, I think that's when we really start to leverage that digital economy. I believe that somebody like a Connect ID could actually lead a lot of that development and design work before the government necessarily had to get involved in the legislation and the regulations.
What do you predict for the future of open data in Australia?
I would like to think that we will achieve the end goal of a true open data economy. I think it is very, very possible. However, for that to happen, our foundation needs to be almost rewritten. We need to rebuild the consumer data right from the bottom up. We need to simplify the rules. We need to simplify the technology that's deployed around that accreditation and the registry. And we need to totally change our mindset when it comes to adding the additional sectors in line with how quickly consumers are digitizing every aspect of their life. If the government really wants to see this succeed, it is more than possible, but they need to go back to the drawing board.
Do you ultimately regret how ambitious CDR was at the start? Or are you still proud of how far you tried to reach?
I am 100% proud of how far we tried to reach. Even though it's slipping out of our grasp, I still believe it is possible. We do have the ability. Every single region, every single country has the ability to achieve this. This isn't just a lofty ambition. This should be the starting line of how the world treats its data. In fact, I'll go one step further. Not only should every nation and region be able to introduce additional data sets and introduce something like a consumer data right, we need to find a way that each country can then connect into other countries. We need to find ways for cross-border data sharing to be achieved, because money is global now, so are citizens. Trade is global. So if we really want to leverage this evolution of data sharing and digital economy, we need to make this global. So my call to arms isn't just for Australia to finish what they started. It's for other regions to strive to achieve the same end goal.
Jamie, where can our guests find out more about you and the work you're doing in Australia?
Absolutely. So happy to share my LinkedIn. For anybody that's going to look into it, you need to put the letter K between my names. There are too many famous Jamie Leeches out there, of which I am not the most famous. So Jamie K. Leech on LinkedIn. Other than that, you can check out Radium Limited and FData, which is the world's leading trade association advocating for the introduction of open data and Open Data Australia, which is my own private organisation. So plenty of places for people to find me, and please reach out if you've got any additional questions.
Thank you for a wonderful conversation, Jamie. It's been great.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Isle. It has been my pleasure.
Open banking journeys always start with big dreams. And nobody dreamt bigger than Australia. The Australian government set themselves the goal of being the first in the world to enshrine true data rights. Broad, clear, legally backed rights applied across the entire economy that allowed you to decide who to share your data with, for how long, and for what purpose. The dream of open data. As we've heard, dreams can sometimes turn into nightmares. Bold ambition can ultimately become a crutch, even more so when there's so much work to be done. Several stumbles later, the consumer data right finds itself in a rather dark place, with adoption stalled and regulatory support in question. Nevertheless, the Australians have persisted. The Trusted Digital Identity Framework, or TDIF, has led to a crop of successful market players like ConnectID. Their efforts have started to chip away at the two other pillars of open banking, digital ID and payments, triggering hope that perhaps this success can rejuvenate the CDR and recalibrate the relationship between market and regulator. Australia's success should be something we all cheer for. They are trailblazing a road that we will all have to walk. The road to data rights.
Thanks for listening to Mr. Open Banking, the podcast that explores the ongoing evolution of open banking and its impact on our lives. Make no mistake, the rise of open banking is going to change financial services forever, and we will be covering that story every step of the way. This is your host, A.L. Savan. Until next time.
This episode of Mr. Open Banking was made possible by Ozone API, providers of the only API platform that supports every open banking standard in the world, unlocking the power of open finance. To learn more, visit ozoneapi.com.